Welcome to episode 172 of the Atomic Powered Supercast with your hosts Andrew and Jen. This week we read Fantastic Four, New Departures, New Arrivals by Matt Fraction. And now, the cast begins.
Okay. Fuck, what's a good word? Okay, everybody, welcome to another cancerous episode of the Atomic Powered Supercast. No, that's bad. That's a bad choice. It's a bad choice. Whatever, I'm going with it anyway. My name is Andy, and I'm hanging out with Jen.
Hey.
And it's just the two of us tonight, because David is not here. He is hanging out, waiting for his second child to be born. So that's fun. We've been planning ahead. He won't be here for the next couple weeks either, but that's okay. We've got special guests coming up. But for right now, we've got Fantastic Four. What was this one called? New Departure, New Arrivals. This one was written by Matt Fraction with art by Mark Bagley in one comic and Mike Allred in the other. Which one was Bagley? Bagley was...
He was Fantastic Four.
And Allred was FF.
FF, yep.
Okay. So this one's a little bit different in that, like, first we did Fantastic Four, and then we did FF. And this storyline puts the two much more close together. So much so that in the trade, you get three issues of Fantastic Four and two issues of FF. Two issues or three? I could never actually track that down.
Two,
okay. We only read two, right?
Yes.
Okay.
As far as I know.
I might have accidentally read three because I really liked FF, so I just kept on reading it.
I almost did, and then was like, nope, I'll get confused.
Well, I will get confused.
So, did you read the trade, or did you read this online?
I read it online.
Okay, same here. I used Marvel Unlimited.
Okay.
And I'm actually really curious as to the order you read it in. Did you intersperse them with each other, or did you do, like, one and then the other?
See, so that's the thing, is I looked it up, and apparently in the trade, it's presented Fantastic Four, FF, Fantastic Four, FF, Fantastic Four. It alternates according to when it came out. How did you read it?
That's actually how I did read it, just because I looked at the advertisement in the back of the first Fantastic Four. Like, they still had that on the online version for some reason. And it said, like, up next is FF. So I was like, okay, let's do that.
Cool.
But I think it works well that way. Although, I don't think it would have detracted from either one if I hadn't read them alternating. Which is nice.
Yeah, I think it works, too, to, like, kind of keep it feeling fresh, you know?
Yeah.
Because that way, like, it's a much easier way to handle a big cast of characters without, like, overrunning your reader or pacing the reader poorly. Like, okay, get Fantastic Four, it's about the family, and you get their story, and then you go read FF, and then that's about everybody else. And sure, they make appearances in each other's titles for, like, this first trade. I'm guessing it doesn't after this, but, like, they're still making appearances with each other, so the overlap is there, but it's much better in that I can read Fantastic Four and think, okay, I don't have to really care about Dragon Man right now. And then when I read FF, I can go, I don't really have to care about Thing right now. Like, it helps your brain kind of compartmentalize the storylines with still knowing that they both exist in tandem.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I think it's one of the best ways to handle a narrative structure when you have a whole bunch of characters. Like, Song of Ice and Fire does the same thing. You only get one character's perspective at a time. And although this is, you know, third-person narration, it still keeps it separate enough. Because last week we had this problem where, at least for me, there was, like, a big barrier to entry.
Yeah.
Reading all these characters and they had just suddenly been introduced. Whereas if one is in one run and then, you know, they don't appear in the other, at least I can kind of compartmentalize who people are and where they should be, like, associated. So that helps out a lot, actually.
Yeah, you know, and I think we rattled off a lot of excuses for it last week, but for some reason this week, I don't think it's just because we read FF by Hickman last week and Fraction this week. I think this one actually did a better job of handling the large cast. I felt way less overwhelmed with the people involved. Maybe it was like the little vignettes with the FF and the kids.
Yeah.
Maybe that really helped to get me have a sense of like who they are. Like the Malloids were like the Malloid like quartet were like, we do everything for the Ben. I was like, oh, you guys are smart and adorable and funky and cool. All right, I like you. Like, it immediately lets me see what their character is like without him to, like, kind of slog through it over five issues while also learning the plot, while also, what the fuck are all these villains? Where the hell are they now? Atlantis? What the hell? Like, it's less of a bombardment of things to try and pick up on when the author just goes, here, this is these characters. Got it? Okay, one page, you're done.
Yeah, it was actually really clever because, like, the layout for this was way more hectic. But it was just, like, all these little editorial things. Like, in the corner of the page, it would say who's talking and where they were.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like, the premise for the kids talking is they're supposed to be telling Ant-Man who they are and what they think the FF is all about and what it means to them. So it's like giving you a broad overview of what this series is going to be, just like we got that one time with the advertisement people talking about who the Fantastic Four were, and it lays it out for the reader really well. And they did this clever little thing, since, you know, the kids are being introduced to new people, they all have name tags.
Yes.
And I love that because...
That was so fucking helpful.
Like, I can't necessarily keep track of all these fucking children.
No, right? I can't either. And I said the Malloid Quartet because I don't remember any of their names. I don't even remember one of their names. There were four of them. I don't remember any.
It's like Mick Tong. I'm reading the name tags.
Okay.
Kor and Turg.
Turg is the one that's a flying head, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
See, like David knows these things. That's why we need him here.
I know. And he's the one who really wanted to do this specific episode. Ah, poor David. He's already going to hate his daughter.
Oh, no.
So the premise for this story is also way less contrived than last week. Like, it's a very simple premise that's going to have repercussions that are as large, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and I think you put it well in the notes.
My bulleted rundown of the plot.
Yes.
I guess I can read that.
Yes.
Okay. They have space cancer and need to go to space to cure it. What? Cliffhanger endings. That was the trade. But,
yeah.
You know, I think that simplicity often leads to a better story. If I look at all my favorite authors in comics or otherwise, simplicity is what they do. And this is nice and simple.
Yeah.
And you can wring a lot out of a simple story. Like, I feel, for instance, that Reed here was actually done fairly well in a very small number of pages, right, because you can see more that he's a person instead of an ego in this, which I think is a problem that Fantastic Four seems to have, like depicting him and making him likable or at least human.
You're going to get, like, it shows you a Reed Richards that's trying to be all intellectual and do it in the smart way, but you're going to get the, like, almost sitcom outcome when they discover that he's actually out there for this reason, and he lied to them all. And, like, you know it's going to happen when they all find out. Like, they're going to get pissed.
Yeah.
Like, why didn't you tell us earlier about this space cancer thing? And so it's cool, because even though he's this super genius and all these kinds of things, and he's doing it because of his ego, it's this thing that you can understand on a fundamental human level. Like, you know what's going to happen. You know why he's doing it. You kind of empathize with him for doing it that way, because he wants to protect them, and maybe he can just go out in space and find a cure and they never have to know. But, like, you know it's going to blow up in his face. It has to blow up in his face.
There's no other way that comics work. And if it doesn't, I'll be very surprised.
Yeah.
But it is also kind of... It works because even though it's something goofy like space cancer from space, I mean, it's a very real fear. People don't want to be worried about the potential that they're dying, and Reed keeping that from his family although it's, like, you know, logically unreasonable, it's very emotionally reasonable. Like, you wouldn't want to tell your family that, and he still, as far as we know, blames himself for getting them into this whole thing in the first place.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's a good way to touch on the fact that guilt is often one of the roots of his character without having to be, like, sob story or explicit about it.
Like Ben Grimm?
Yeah, man.
Who is... We've read... Okay, like, when I was a kid, I used to think that Ben Grimm was fucking cool because he said clobbering time and he punched things, right? I used to like Ben Grimm. After these last 3 weeks, I don't think he's that great anymore because he is
kind of emo
and sad all the time.
He's super famous, super rich. He has all these friends. Kids look up to him, and he's like, "I'm so ugly." Oh, like, dude, just
I don't even know what he's sad about. He's in the fucking outer space plane, and he doesn't want to go down with them. I don't know why.
And I feel like we were supposed to pick up something dark about that because the kids commented on it.
I don't know. Maybe it's something we're supposed to know from a previous run of FF or Fantastic Four, but I'm like, all right, Ben, I'm done with you. Like, the whole thing you did on the Yancey Street was kind of funny with them in the internet and asking how you delete something off the internet. Like, that was kind of cool. And I like how it's like a game between them, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
He thinks these kids are stupid-ass street punks, and so he wants to go down there and teach them a lesson. All the while forgetting that he used to be a stupid-ass street punk. And knows that he cannot teach them a lesson. You know, like, it's never going to work. And I love the back and forth between him and that gang of kids. I love it!
Yeah. You know, the YouTube video was actually one of my favorite parts of this.
Oh, really?
Well, it's the six panels showing him, like, coming at the camera, and then it's like a screenshot, and at the bottom you can see the likes going up, and on panel six it has 1 million likes.
Oh, I didn't even see the likes going up.
I love that. It was hilarious.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Pun intended. I also really did like Ben's interactions with She-Hulk in this.
Yeah.
Friendly rivalry? Yeah. Like, I like Ben when he's being clever. Like, his best attribute is when he's bantering. And he banters really well with Johnny. He banters really well with She-Hulk. And anytime we see that, I think he's a really likable character. But when he gets, like, all sulky, I can't handle it.
Yeah, you know, and you're right. Like, I mean, you list off the stuff, like, he's rich and popular and famous and all these kinds of things. But, like, I get the emotional scar you have from this happening. I mean, I understand all that. But that's the only thing I can imagine that he's still hanging on to. And how is that still relevant? How long has it been? Not only have everybody else moved on from it, but, like, they moved on to the point where they have a normal family life and kids now. And you're still being fucking moody about it? I don't understand. That's the only thing I can think of him being moody about.
Yeah, it's... Oh my goodness. So, Fantastic Four started in 1961. It's been way too long for Ben to be this sad about it. They need to develop his character. And I know they're... Like, we've discussed... Like, I'm not a fan of Clobber in Time, for instance, or Flame On.
Love it.
But I understand the need to keep, like, core parts of who characters are. That's what sells, and that's what's lovable about them. But I don't necessarily think that, unless they, I don't know, add a greater facet of emotional depth to his unhappiness about it, it's getting old. It's not a core part of his character the way it used to be.
Yeah. And it just, it's not that it makes him seem vain, it just makes him seem, it takes a character that should be badass and cool and makes him seem moody and emo, and not in any positive way like with Batman.
Yeah.
There's nothing about his being moody that contributes to the character, contributes to the story. Throughout these three trades, it's been the most annoying thing is the, like, the darkly shaded panels of Ben Grimm. Like, what? No, I hate it. I hate it so much.
Especially after Johnny Storm died.
Yeah.
When he was just, like, hiding in his room with the kids.
I mean, that's kind of reasonable.
Yeah, but...
Like, yeah.
I think, but that's the thing. It would have been way more sad if he hadn't had that personality trait before it.
Yeah.
Like, if he had not been emo about things, and then Johnny died and he went through this crisis, I think it would have had way better impact.
Yeah, but, you're right. It's kind of like, oh, he's a depressive kind of guy, and then something bad happens. Of course, he's just going to get super fucking depressed. But you know what? On the flip side, I've discovered that I really, really, really love Johnny Storm.
Yes, because he is great.
I used to think he was just, like stupid, just like the typical stupid character. And not in any fun kind of way. Like, Guy Gardner is a typical stupid character in a fun kind of way. But I like Johnny. When he has the reminder alert on his phone, ask about that thing. And then he asks Darla, hey, what do you think about the thing? That's fucking genius. And then you get the little vignettes of them asking the people, and then it's just like them tumbling around.
Yeah. Oh god, the best thing is the first two are like, yes, I'll do it, and she just goes, wee!
Wee!
Right? I love that panel.
And then it comes back later on to it, does the same thing when they were when they're all sitting around like the table at like the panic floor for like the big meeting, and they all look to Johnny and they're like, Johnny, did you forget to do something really important?
And he's like, oh, shit.
Damn.
See, I think he's great because he's the sort of character you can kind of sympathize with.
Yeah.
Like, his screw-ups are very normal person. They're not necessarily, like, deeply emotional, and they don't always destroy the galaxy. But he messes up, and it's stuff that you or I could do.
Yeah.
If we were, like, CFOs of a major superhero corporation.
And I think he also... I mean, we talk about our frustration with Ben Grimm as a character. In, like, you have all this and that and the other thing. How can you possibly be sad? We look at Johnny Storm and, like, you have this, that, and the other thing. Your life is awesome, right? And Johnny goes, fuck yeah, it is, bro! And so, I relate to Johnny. Because I say, hey, Johnny, is your life awesome? Johnny goes, yeah, buddy. Like, it's immediately understandable. Ben Grimm, I go, how's life, Ben? I'm sad. Okay, I'll go hang out with Johnny again.
You know, it's like you and David said. He would get along perfectly with Booster Gold.
Yeah.
And it's that personality type that makes him so likable. It's... He just, you know, he wants to have fun and doesn't really... He's not worried, but he cares. Yeah. And that's what makes him likable. It's not like he's a douche.
Do we get much of Sue at all in this? And her character? I don't really feel like we did.
No, we never do. Unless, I mean...
Well, she's the invisible woman.
Angry feminist rant right there. Let's pretend we went through that. And okay. It is interesting. They do frame her more and more as a mother.
Mm-hmm.
She... is kind of the force that holds together the FF. You know, like, she goes and you can see her just checking in on them right before bedtime. She deals with all, like, the trouble, like, you know, when they smash the dinner table and trash the bathroom, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And I know that there are a lot of people out there who have voiced complaints that that's her role, but she's really good at it, and every time we see her in action in a fight, she's really strong. And I don't necessarily think she's... I mean, she does need way more characterization. She needs more depth. There's no doubt about that, but I don't think there's anything wrong with her as a, like, being portrayed as a mother.
No, I think people who would have a problem with that should look at comics and see how few female characters have their shit together enough to be a superhero mom.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's really, really tough to be a parent, and if you can be a superhero at the same time, I don't think that motherhood would detract from your superheroics. It makes you a stronger character because you're dealing with normal person life on top of superhero life.
Yeah, so there aren't a whole lot of happy marriages in comics, and the few that there are, the mother is not the superhero.
Yes, that's true. So Sue Storm is one of the very few, like, actual mother figures that we see. And she has her shit together. She's always calm, always collected. And she's a strong character in that regard. So I do like that.
I feel like the best opportunity we got to get to know her was when she was talking one-on-one to Medusa.
Yes.
Like, those interactions. Like, it's kind of funny when they, like, introduce them as equal queens. But then there's, like, the little hints, like, when they were, what was it? They were sipping something out on the edge of a building or the edge of a ship or something.
Yeah, it's like they're having a cocktail or something.
Yeah, and it was fucking, it was hilarious. The way they were talking about, like, their kids and being parents and having to look out for people. And it's like, they're talking about this thing that's relatable to every family in existence, but they're doing it as superheroes and queens and leaders of their people.
See, that's kind of the cool thing. It's like, I feel like it's really hard to relate to Reed Richards. And
yeah.
Johnny and the Thing each kind of have their own little groups that they appeal to, but I feel like Sue kind of has the more, like, universal human experience under lock there. Like, she just gets what it is to be a normal family person.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I do want to see more of her because I feel like she doesn't get that much stage time or characterization. And she actually is pretty cool. They've developed her a lot from when, you know, the comic was running. What was it? When we read about Galactus.
Oh,
and
yeah.
She just, like, did nothing. She was like,
eh. Right? Well, it's also when she could only turn invisible, I think. She couldn't do any of this Force Barrier. But I think, like, also, I don't know, when I was reading this, I got a slight tinge of, did they overcompensate for the whole invisible woman feminist backlash thing by making her, like, a queen on top of everything else? Like, maybe it's because I didn't read that series, but I have no fucking clue what she could possibly have to do with Atlantis and these fish people.
Yeah, it seems really tangential to everything, except for, like, the two fish kids that hang out in the Baxter building. But
I don't know.
Like that they gave her more powers. And the thing, too, is you see her exerting effort every time she uses her powers. It's not like it's easy to do what she does. Yeah. And I like that.
Yeah. So that's all of the norm, like, the traditional Fantastic Four. What do we think of this FF, this new four of replacements?
These four are great.
I fucking love them.
Okay, so first off, what do you actually know about Darla?
I know the only person that I know more of than what I've read in this book is She-Hulk. Other than that, I know nothing more than what's in here.
Okay, because I'm under the impression that Darla is in the Fantastic Four because she's sleeping with Johnny.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Darla's like some, just like pop star, and Johnny wants to bang her. And she just happens to be in bed when he gets the alert that says, ask about the thing.
I mean, clearly, like, he does trust her. He would, deep down inside, he is responsible, so that must vouch for her.
Yeah.
But I like her storyline just because it's like, what would a normal person do if their boyfriend was like, okay, now you're in the Fantastic Four, too bad, you can't take it back, like, no takesies backsies, right? And oh, she had the best response too when Mole Man came and Dragon Man said, okay, you got to go out there and do your thing. She just goes, no.
Yeah. Like, what the fuck is she going to do out there?
That is a completely legitimate response. She's gonna die.
Yeah.
Because
she would be, like, the person who gets in the way. She would, like, the way you always have a hero like Medusa on crowd control clearing the citizens away, Medusa would clear her away along with everybody else. Yeah, but I'm interested to see what this Thing outfit does on her. Because that's going to look hilarious with a Thing's body and her head coming out.
The covers are great because of that. I mean, if you look at some of the future ones, they are just amazing.
I especially love the cover to issue with, hold on, let me go back. Is it 4 or 5? The one with the Molloys in love with Jen.
Number 4,
because they call her the Jen. Do everything for the Jen, because it's like Ben, and she's strong. But it's she's a she. Just like,
she's the stand-in. Oh, that's great.
But she's strong. She's like, I imagine their infatuation is like, what if you could give your best, from the dude's point of view, like, what if you could give your best friend boobs? Couldn't you just marry her? Like, you see that come up, like, in stuff all the time. And I, like, they're quirky enough, they'd be like, yeah, let's go for it. It's the Jen.
I love the Malloids. They are great.
I have to say, I don't know if I'll keep reading this Fantastic Four. I really do want to go back and read the Mark Waid run, because I really think that Mark Waid and I are, like, on the same page when it comes to what we want out of comics. Like, a complex story, but people don't have to die. Come on, bro. But, like, this FF, I really want to read this FF run.
Yes.
It just feels fantastic to me.
It feels classic. I mean, in the art, in the story, in the style, in the whole aesthetic, in that, like, nice, light, funny way, but it's still engaging. There's nothing stupid about it.
Yeah.
And that's what I really like. I mean, it just, it's paying tribute to all the goofiness that's come before. But at the same time, it's just so enjoyable. I really, really loved FF.
Yeah, and I really liked all the, like, I want to talk about the art right now. Like, you get so much of these characters just based on the little changes in facial expression that they have, like, panel to panel. What's the one where the Fantastic Four leave and Ant-Man is just standing there counting down? And it's nothing but him wearing his helmet. And all you see is, like, the helmet changing direction just ever so slightly. And then one of the Malloids says, oh, no. And he says, what do you mean, oh, no? And then, like, two panels later, he says, oh, no.
Yeah.
It's just, like, it's so simple and subtle and small, but you get such a feeling of, like, you get such a feeling of emotion from these characters just off of these little movements and little nuances. I think is a real tribute to this art style.
They also do the really good, like, real-life action shots. Like, they have Ant-Man eating cereal.
Yeah. Right,
and trying to talk to people, or when Johnny checks the calendar on his phone and it says ask somebody about the thing, like, the look on his face is just, it's the best puzzled look. He's like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah. And then I love all of She-Hulk's, like, random faces. She'll be like, there was a series where she was, like, in the front of the frame and people were talking behind her and she just has, like, these reaction faces to them and they're all priceless. They're like, what the fuck? Huh?
Yeah.
And then, like, a little laugh.
I think the kids are really well done as well in this. Like, the scene where two of the mutants go and they start crawling all over Darla while she's doing yoga.
Oh, yes.
It's so cute, and it's exactly what little kids do. They, like, get in your lap and ask you weird questions and talk about boop-boop machines.
Yep. Oh, yeah, the boop-boop machine.
I love how Ant-Man uses that term, too. He's like, the boop-boop machine is booping.
Well, he doesn't know what the name of the machine is. Yeah, Reed's not there.
It's so great.
And I like the irony, too, that you get reading the first issue as a reader when the Fantastic Four are going around everybody telling them it's only going to be 4 minutes. And as a reader, you're like, bro, this is a new series. It ain't going to be 4 minutes long. I'll tell you that right now. I like that feeling of, like, the real irony where the reader knows something that the character obviously does not, and getting to see the character interact in a way not knowing what you know. It's just and then getting that payoff when you do see the reaction when they realize, oh no, it's been more than 4 minutes.
And, you know, they really acknowledge it so clearly, too. Where they don't make a fuss, no one even says, like, oh, they're so late. It's just day one, and then it goes straight to day two, and then day three.
Yep.
And it's like, yep, that was going to happen.
Well.
So, what did you think of the endings? Because these were both cliffhangers.
Okay, remind me where issue two of FF landed, because I went ahead and read 3 and 4.
Crazy Johnny comes out of the sky.
Oh, yeah. Is it really Johnny?
I don't know. He's got a mask on and he's on fire. So it's a mystery thus far.
I mean, cliffhangers are good. Right? I feel like they generally are.
I liked this one. I am psyched to read the next two. But then the one for... Okay, I guess it's not really a cliffhanger, Fantastic Fours, because they say something like, okay, we're going to not get into trouble, and then there's a little editorial note that says something like, and then everything went horrible.
No, it says, like, no more problems, and it says, next month, more problems.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, that's just, that's cute. That's good tongue-in-cheek. I think that's something you can only really do in a title like Fantastic Four that has such a cheesy vibe to it. But I really love the FF ones. I feel like a good cliffhanger really enhances a story, whereas a bad one kind of just makes you go, oh, well, okay, whatever. Like, did you ever watch Farscape?
Yes.
Farscape season enders are the best. If you think about, if anybody out there likes cliffhangers and sci-fi, go watch Farscape. The first season kind of sucks. But once you get to the last episode of the first season, these cliffhangers are brutal. The guy is just, like, floating in space and everybody around him is dead, and there's nothing for thousands of light years. He's just there, floating. Season ends. It's like, what the fuck? It just had epic cliffhangers, and that's like the thing I remember about that show. It would made me keep wanting to watch that show because the cliffhangers would just be brutal. You're like, okay, I don't really care about the story anymore, but I want to know how the hell they write themselves out of this. You know? And so, like, for Fantastic Four and FF, like, all right, that's Johnny Storm. Or is it? Is he old? What is this? What the fuck is happening here? Okay, I guess I'll read the next one. It just makes you want to keep reading it to figure out how they write themselves out of this cliffhanger.
Yeah, and see, that's the thing. Like, the FF one, I'm really curious to see how the FF is going to deal with it. Because I don't know, I mean, I don't know how good at dealing with things they are. I have doubts at this point. But Fantastic Four, it wasn't that it was a, like, suspenseful or poorly done cliffhanger. We don't even have to call it a cliffhanger. It was just like, there will be more trouble. But it's a comic, so that's a given.
Yeah.
It just felt like a very nebulous ending.
Well, and I think, like, the premise for Fantastic Four is laid out there, and it's so simple and ripe for storytelling, right? Like, they have space cancer, so they need to go to the space to find the space cure for space cancer in space, right? And it's like, it's really simple, but it sets up this huge dynamic for space cancer storytelling, for, oh my god, Reed Richards lied to his family storytelling, and who has the cure for space cancer, like, all this kind of stuff. And instead, the first thing we get when they get to outer space is, like, a monster of the week.
Yeah.
And it's like, I have a lot of comics to read, and as much as I liked the premise for this and the setup for it, I got a lot of comics to read, and I don't have a whole lot of time for Monster of the Week, unless it's a comic that I really like, you know, or characters that I really love. Like, I feel like I'm attached to FF enough that I'm down for an FF Monster of the Week, because there's going to be funny stuff happening along the side. Fantastic Four, along the side, I'm going to get Sad Ben Grimm. And I'm not down for Sad Ben Grimm in a Monster of the Week. I want shit to be moving along. And so I feel like the idea is great, but then once you get out to space, you kind of figure out, oh, this is actually really nebulous, and they don't really have a goal of where to go or a thing to do. They're just kind of out for adventure with space cancer.
Yeah, that was... I don't know. It needs a more solid plot, and that's the thing. At least with FF, even if there's not a set timeline, there's a goal. And it's just to hold down the fort until the actual Fantastic Four comes back.
Yeah.
But, and the thing too is, you know, they kind of had some, like, foreshadowing. Franklin had that dream, which we assume is prophetic, about them not going to space.
Yeah.
And then Sue acknowledges it once. I feel like they could have done maybe a little more with that, and it doesn't all have to be in one issue or two, because they have time, but make it seem a little more, I don't know, dire to be out there instead of weird, I don't know, fish planets.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I guess that depends on Sue's relationship with Franklin, because really, kids, like, get really stressed out about random shit. Like, I've got a niece that just, like, there was, a week where she was just freaked out to fuck that there was a skunk inside the house because she had a skunk in her dream. And so she was, like, constantly running around, like, wondering if she could go into the next room or if the skunk was in there. And, like, no matter how much you told her, there's not a fucking skunk anywhere in this goddamn house. She was afraid of a skunk for, like, a week, you know? So, like, I could totally see Sue being like, yeah, yeah, space, dear. It's terrible. Oh, Franklin, oh, space. And then, like, next week saying, Franklin, get the fuck over it. We're going to space for a year.
Yeah.
Like, space is fine. There's no goddamn skunk in the spaceship. Let's go.
But see, that's where the authors could have used, you know, like, their third-person powers to show us that it's not just kids freaking out, but maybe he, you know, he does have powers, right? He's the world's most powerful mutant.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So,
or, if you're going to do the tongue-in-cheek thing on the last page, have the last page of issue one be, like, the last panel is Franklin going, I don't want to go to outer space. Next month, they go to outer space.
Yeah.
Like, then you're acknowledging that his fear of outer space, like, it's not just prophetic. It's, like, it's going to be a thing. And even if Sue doesn't acknowledge it, you can get that kind of, like, I mean, I know as a reader, we know it's a thing. You don't put a dream in a comic. You don't put a dream in any story and then don't do something with it. Dreams are especially important in any kind of storytelling. But it's just, yeah. You're right. It just wasn't quite enough there by the end of this trade.
That's the frustration. In stories, people can't just be normal people. They don't have normal experiences because otherwise we wouldn't be reading this story. Yeah. So we have to assume greater meaning. But then if you don't deal with that meaning, it just becomes like, well, why'd you tell me that thing?
Yeah. I mean, well, that's the truth. You can't have normal people doing normal experiences, but you can have abnormal people doing normal experiences, which I think is Fantastic Four. These are very abnormal people going on a road trip, going on a family road trip, in their own way because they're abnormal people. And that's supposed to what's make it more interesting is that they're abnormal. Or you get the opposite, which is FF. You get normal people. They're superheroes, so they're not normal, but they seem pretty normal to me. Like, Jennifer Walters is a fucking lawyer by day and really just She-Hulk for shits and giggles. It's like people who go mountain climbing, right? And Ant-Man, he's a convicted criminal, for God's sakes. Like, he's just a normal dude who happens to have this technology that makes him grow small, so he wants to use it to help people. Right, like, they seem like normal people. They're not the kind of people who are going to build a fucking Baxter building and proclaim themselves Imaginauts. It's not what these people are going to do. These are relatively normal people in a really abnormal situation. And so, like, they both kind of, I don't know, just FF is so much more interesting.
Yeah.
Because it's great that the Fantastic Four are quote-unquote abnormal people in a normal situation, but they've been around for 50 years. And this is their kind of set idea of who they are, and they're going on a road trip. I think it just comes down to, like, the fact that the first story of them in space is a monster of the week. I think that's my big problem with it.
Yeah, it's like they have a purpose for going out there, so you want some feeling of purposeful journey. I don't know. Like, it needed to feel more cohesive.
Yeah.
Even a hint at that, because it's fine if you draw it out, especially if you intend the run to last a few years. But, I don't know, it's just, we've seen all the little side stories before, so they've grown trite. We need something, I don't know, thought out.
Yeah. Or even in that Monster of the Week story, some hint that anything they've done that episode or that issue matters to the space cancer, whatever, right? Like, it seemed in the beginning like it was going to matter, but then it turned out that it didn't at all, which is a terrible bait and switch.
Yeah, I mean, that was the thing. Like, his arm's actually falling apart and his powers stop working, and then it's never addressed again.
Go back and kill that damn animal and take that planet thing out of it, and then be ruthless. Come on, Reed. I don't give a shit. Well, who's your favorite character in this?
Probably Johnny. I think it's just, he was the most fun and interesting, and I really liked how he just chose, like, a random person to be in the Fantastic Four in his stead.
Hey, I'm
like,
begging you right now, you wouldn't be in the Fantastic Four.
Yeah, it's like, you think that he would pick maybe Spider-Man?
Yeah,
I don't know, like, someone You know, he even said, have Spider-Man replace me when he died. So why not go back and be like, can you sub in for 4 minutes? But, no, he just picked, like, the first person who was in front of him.
Well, because he didn't know that's what he was supposed to be doing. He didn't know that's what the thing was.
It's just great. But, yeah, he had a fun character in this. I appreciated him.
For me, it's a toss-up kind of between Ant-Man and Medusa. And I'm really surprised to say this because I love She-Hulk. I love her to death. She's one of my favorite characters. But for me, I really liked Ant-Man coming in and, like, he comes in and he introduces himself to the Future Foundation like the way a middle manager would.
Yes.
So, let's all have a group meeting, give me all your names, and talk about what the company means to you. It's like the first day of class when you hand out a syllabus and everybody just wants to tell you bullshit and go home. It's like, bro, you're really way out of your depth right here, aren't you? You're doing a real good job trying to hold it together, but you're way out of your depth. The other character that Medusa, I loved her just from one panel when they're standing in front of her and she leans over and she says, "Why aren't they bowing?"
That was good.
Like, oh, Medusa, I want to hug you because you just don't understand.
You know what else was great with her? When she was lying in bed ringing the bell with her hair.
Yes.
She's like, why is no one coming to help me?
I'm a queen. Where are the servants?
That was great.
And, of course, she would expect servants because she greets Sue as a fellow queen, and she's in Sue's house. So Sue is a queen. Obviously, Sue has servants. I'm going to ring my bell, and those servants will come and help me. Like, it kind of makes sense if you just assume that all queens of any whatever the hell have servants or whatever the fuck to help her. But it's just like, no. Just gonna stay in bed. And then she ends up having to go out into the fight in her nightie.
Yes. Jumping out of a window.
Yes.
No less.
Yeah, I really liked her. I liked her a lot more than I thought I would. Especially considering my low, like, level of exposure to the Inhumans. Which they were in the last run, too, weren't they?
Yeah, they were. We saw her, actually.
Yeah. And then Black Bolt did something. I don't even remember.
He was, like, sitting really angrily on a chair, that's right. And that was the cliffhanger.
Black Bolt is angry. Cliffhanger. Dun-dun-dun. So we already talked about this. You prefer the FF art, right?
Yeah, I think, well, it's not that I actually prefer it. In fact, it was really jarring at first, and I like the Fantastic Four art. I don't think they're comparable.
Yeah, it's kind of like apples and oranges.
Yeah, it's a whole different aesthetic. What I will say is that I think each art style fits its story very well.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. Because Fantastic Four's art is very much classic comic book art, and they're very much a, let's go out into space for a year and have funsies. You know, like, it's the same kind of, like, it's classic storybook premise, just with cancer thrown in there. But yeah, FF, like, it's much more, the art is much more, like, flat and stilted, and it's, like, sometimes the transition between frames is a little awkward. There's just a natural slight level of awkwardness with this art, which is perfect, because these people are kind of awkward with each other right now.
You know, the style's great in that. It actually, when I saw the first page, it reminded me of Boxers and Saints a little bit. Like, some of the way the faces were drawn, especially when, like, Franklin and Val are making faces in front of, you know, like, straight out the panel at you.
Oh, yes.
And I was just looking at that and thinking, this is really more like comics with the X. You know, it's the underground art style, it goes against, like, I don't know, all the other tropes. It's counterculture. But then it's also mixed with that very classic, like, 1950s, 60s vibe to it. With just a little pop art. Like, oh man, the scene where it shows Ant-Man crying, holding his daughter.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it even has, like, the fake moiré effect that you would get from a printing press, but it's been digitized and put in there, and it has, like, the spiky frame. And then, like, Reed Richards is all in the background, like, outside the frame. He's twisting all around it. It's a really neat mishmash of styles.
Yeah.
That fits this, because this is, like, a little bit contemporary, a little bit counter to what Fantastic Four is, and then a little bit just, like, tongue-in-cheek wacky playing on how goofy old comics used to be. Like, when Mole Man comes in and he says, like, something, "Fools, I'm the greatest foe the Fantastic Four has ever fought," and it feels so goofy.
Yeah.
And anything that was meant to be serious would just be bad, but because it's parody, it's funny, and then the art is kind of like that old art. It works.
Yeah.
Really, I don't know. I liked it. That's...
Yeah. Well, I mean, I guess this episode will be a little bit short because we're sans David, but I don't really have anything else to say about this. Do you?
No, I think... I mean, we did the rundown of all our normal points, so...
We have checked all the boxes.
Yep. We should rate this thing.
All right. How about I go first?
Sure.
Since David complains that I never go first, the week that he's not here, I will go first. Take that, David. I will give this... it's so tough. Because I'm super interested in reading FF, and I'm super not interested in reading Fantastic Four. I kind of want to know how Reed Richards cures space cancer, but I feel like I can just pick up issue 20 and be done. Or whatever the hell happens. But FF, I want to see them all the way along the way. Ah, so it's tough. I'm going to give it a 3-3. Because I feel like Fantastic Four is about normal, about par for the course. Maybe a little bit less, I think, because it just immediately devolves into Monster of the Week once they get into space. Whereas, like I said before, there are so many comics these days that just don't do that. Or if it is Monster of the Week, there's a much better veneer on it than this. It's not so transparent. So I think my two and a, my regular like average is going to be lowering, because I feel like the quality of comics has been rising the last couple of years. But FF, I think, is solidly like a 3.5 or 4 for me. So I think on the whole, I'm going to give it a 3. I really want to keep reading this FF, and I'm not going to read Fantastic Four anymore. I'm going to go back and I'm going to read the Mark Waid run before I read this one. Which I don't feel like I'm slighting the writer, because he wrote both. So it's clearly just a difference in what Matt Fraction was trying to do with each run.
Yeah.
Right? And it's like, all right, Matt, I like your idea here, and swing and a miss, but it's cool because I love you anyway. You do all kinds of great work, but I'm going to read this one. So 3. Jen?
That's reasonable. I'm going to go with a 3 as well.
Oh, right.
Because I totally agree with what you're saying there. I'm going to go and read more of FF. I'm not going to read more Fantastic Four. I mean, if I had all the time in the world, sure. But I got, you know, there's a list. And if the comic gets on it, it's actually pretty good. So I would give FF like a 4, maybe even a 4.5 if we kept reading and it stays this good. It's just so appealing. I was going to say it has that je ne sais quoi that comics sometimes have, where you just want to read them.
Yeah. And I think it both helps and hurts both of these runs that they are connected but separate. And I'm sure that by the end, once we when the Fantastic Four come back, these two books are going to sync back up. And if there's time in between where they're completely apart, I'm sure that's going to happen too. It's a good idea, But I also really appreciate the way that Matt Fraction's written them both so that you don't have to read them both.
Yeah.
You don't have to subscribe to both. If you do it, you're going to get a much bigger, much more comprehensive story, and they're meant to be read together, but you don't have to. Which I think it's neat the way they're packaging them together in trade paperback. The way that if you buy Fantastic Four Volume 1, you get Fantastic Four and FF in the same trade because they're one big story. I love that idea, but I think if I had bought this as opposed to getting it through MDCU, I'd be like, aw, can I just get 5 issues of FF next time? <Yeah. laughs> It's a good idea, and I really appreciate that they're trying new things, and even if it doesn't work, you got to keep trying. Because if they hadn't done this, we might have just read Fantastic Four and not FF, you know?
That's true, and we would have been missing out, certainly.
We would have been missing out, and frankly, I love FF, and I'm going to keep reading the shit out of it. So I keep trying things, comics. You'll find something eventually. You'll get that.
Such encouragement.
Yeah. So, like I mentioned at the top of the show, David will not be with us for a couple weeks. So next week, we're starting a series of comics that he suggested.
Of course.
He really wanted to read Kyle Rayner and Guy Gardner comics and the Sinestro Corps War. He really wanted to read them, and he really wanted to be a part of those episodes. So we're doing them starting next week when he's gone. But we're going to have a special guest host, my buddy John Pingle. I've done previous shows with him before. Not this show, but like previous podcast projects with him before. He does podcasts himself. He's a cool guy, at Team Hate on Twitter. And he's a Green Lantern fanatic. So he will be with us for the next 4 episodes. We're going to do Green Lantern, Power of Ion. This is from 2001. Written by Judd Winnick, and it collects Green Lantern 142 to 150. This kind of picks up more or less where we finished off with our previous Green Lantern series. At the end of the last Green Lantern series, all the Guardians were dead except for Ganthet, and Kyle Rayner was the one left living Green Lantern, except for Parallax, who was the crazy Hal Jordan. So the Power of Ion is the story of Kyle Rayner completely embracing his role as the last living Green Lantern and everything that that means. And then the week after that, we'll read Green Lantern Corps Volume 1, which is subtitled To Be a Lantern. That's our Guy Gardner story. That's written by Dave Gibbons with art by Patrick Gleason. That collects Green Lantern Corps 1-6 from 2006. Green Lantern Corps with Dave Gibbons and Patrick Gleason is like my favorite run of Green Lantern comics ever. I'm really going to enjoy reading it as part of the show. And then after that, we're going to do 2 episodes, Green Lantern and Sinestro Corps War, Volume 1, and then another show, Volume 2. So that's going to be the next 4 weeks coming up. If you didn't catch all that, that's cool. It's fine. Just go to www.atomicpoweredsupercast.com or apsupercast.com. We own 2 domains now because we're baller like that. And on the right, there's a button that says Future Shows. Click on that bad boy, and there'll be a whole list of everything we've got coming up for the next couple weeks. If you have a suggestion for what we should read after that, because David's not here, so we're down a man for suggesting things, you can go ahead and send us an email at
AtomicPoweredSupercast@gmail.com.
There's also always the social media stuff, Facebook.com/APSupercast, Twitter.com/APSupercast, and our real jam, APSupercast.tumblr.com. And as always, please subscribe to us on
iTunes.
Yeah. All right. Until next time. Goodbye.
Goodbye.